Welcome to this five-part grazing podcast series brought to you by the BC Forage Council and the Peace River Forage Association. This chat is with Norm Ward. Norm shares his passion for intensive rotational grazing and how it led to the development of the original Range Ward products. He shares some of his early lessons learned, why electrical fencing does neither have to be intimidating nor frustrating, and some of his key tips on how to make your transition to electric fencing a bit more grounded and less electrocuting, if you know what I mean. Funding for this project has in part been provided by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada through the Agriculture Climate Solutions Living Labs program. Welcome, Norm, and thank you for joining us today on the podcast here. I'm really excited to chat with you a little bit about your experience in the livestock industry and what brought you down the rabbit hole of where you went with the innovations that you created with your company. So maybe for those of us who are not that familiar with your background, how on earth did you get started in this business?
Well, I had the opportunity to go to university, and I took some animal science and grazing management as a major, and then had an opportunity to be with Alan Savory for about a week, 1987. And we were on a ranch. My wife and I had a ranch in, first in Brooks and then over in Granham, Alberta. So I had an opportunity to take some of those principles and play a little bit, make mistakes. And it was great because we lived at the end of the road. So we made lots of mistakes and nobody got to see them because we made lots of them. We kind of fumbled along. We did some holistic management, raised a family there. And back about in the late 90s, early 2000s, we started to get a little more serious. At one point, we got rid of our 550 head of cows and went into the grazing steers or heifers for the summer months. And then that really ratcheted up our management, our holistic management that goes with it, and our adaptive grazing that we had to do. So back then, we had about 40 paddocks on the ranch. The ranch was about 8,000 acres, and we were rotating cattle through. When we first started with the steers, we bought about 900 steers. We had about 550 cows, so we thought that was about what we needed. And as we increased our animal density and kind of moved ahead in that direction, 4 years later, we had 2,000 steers, and we were grazing the neighbors' cows in the wintertime as well. And it was just a tremendous change that came with that adaptive management that we did.
So when you did that, you said that was in the 90s, right? So you would have been a bit ahead of the curve in terms of trying some of these practices, having smaller paddocks, having higher stock densities. What was sort of the perception of you in the community? Like, how did that go down?
Well, it was interesting. When I left the Savory course, Alan said, don't go home and fence. But I did. And of course, fencing is just one of the tools that you could use with holistic management. Really, it's about managing a water cycle, a mineral cycle, energy flow, and succession. And yeah, everybody gets into the tools and the fencing tools. So we did that. And I can remember fencing off a small section of some very old rough fescue grass. So this would be rough fescue that's gray, started to go black. It's literally oxidizing into the air. And we were going to do some high density grazing, kind of put some of that material back onto the ground. And it was in June. It was a small field, maybe 70, 80 acres. I put about 550 cows in there. All the cows did was bawl for about 3 days next to my neighbor's place. So he really thought I had gone off the deep end. And we went back in the winter and did some winter grazing with some protein source. And we were able to change that grass, kind of open up the grassland a little bit, that old, dense, rough fescue, bumpy type space. You know, probably 5 or 6 years later, we probably had 30%, maybe more plants. So we started to cover some of the bare ground between the big plants and an active green community, dynamic community, I would suggest. So that was some of the changes. So yeah, the neighbors were kind of watching over the fence.
Interesting. Yeah. It sounds like you had a community that had built up so much litter. Like, litter is good to a certain point, right? But then you seem to have a community where there was so much litter that it started to kind of choke out the grass underneath. So, and you were trying to open that up a bit?
Yeah. We bought this ranch in 1980, and previous management was, of course, continuous grazing. So there was a lot of places on the ranch where the cattle stayed for the summer. So lots of overgrazed places, and then lots of underutilized places. And those underutilized places were on hills. Keep in mind where this ranch was in the Porcupine Hills. So lots of elevation change, lots of diverse communities. And those higher places on, for instance, a north-facing slope were not utilized very well. So we had this old decadent forage that was there, and we needed to reopen the community a little bit.
So you mentioned after the course, you did go home, and despite the advice, you went and fenced. So I assume at that time you permanent fenced.
Yeah, we started off with with two-wire fence, electric high tensile fencing. And at that point, we were building fence for about $400 a mile. I had traded my grass insurance off and started using that money to build electric fence. So we had made about 40 paddocks, and we had some old barbed wire fences that we utilized, some high tensile, the new high tensile wire. And then later on, when we got rid of the cows and started to do some summer grazing with some stalkers, we started to add some portable fence. And that's really what drove us at that point. We needed some temporary portable fence. There wasn't anything on the market. So we just started to build our own, right? Design our own. So that's where we got started.
So not unusual. The innovation came out of necessity, right? So you were wanting to get more into this portable fencing option. You recognized the need for that, and there was nothing there. So tell me a little bit more about your first innovation. Was that the razor grazer that you built at the time?
Yeah, it's actually what we ended up calling the power grazer. So it's a little larger trailer, still small enough to run around with a quad or a side-by-side. We put a couple miles of what we used at that time, which was Gallagher Equibraid rope, which was a pretty good product. And I can remember rolling up by hand the first 2 miles that we had out. And it's like, yeah, we can do this. And then I had someone else help me that did the same thing. And it's like, no, we're not going to do that again. So we searched around for an electric motor, and we just started to build around what we needed. So back then we went from 40 paddocks to about 80 paddocks. So through the summer we grazed through about 80 paddocks from May until October, sort of thing. So we needed the flexibility. Some of those fields we may have fenced with portable fence into three, some into halves. Some were smaller fields that we had. So think of a very diverse landscape and extremely diverse fence. So really what we were doing was fencing similar ecosystems. So south-facing slopes away from north-facing slopes. We had a little bit of tame pasture that was there. We fenced those out. Valley bottoms, riparian areas, those type of things. So we started to move around and fence those. And in most cases, we went from about, when the cows were there, we had about 15 to 20,000 pounds of animal per acre per day, which we thought was pretty good. And then eventually we got to, with the steers, about 100,000 pounds of animal per acre per day. So more moves, more diverse terrain. It was pretty cool. It was lots of fun.
You can tell that these are high numbers. And maybe for somebody who's more of a visual person, like what would that look like on the landscape? That's a significant amount of animals in a fairly condensed space, right?
Yeah. And like 100,000 pounds is there's animals that and they're not touching each other, of course. But they're when you look at it out at it, there's you can see four or five in a pretty small space. Our people we meet on meet through our range ward business. I'm thinking of Ryan Boyd out in Manitoba. I think he's at about 1.2 million pounds of animal per acre. That's where animals almost touch each other. And to reach that, they probably move six or eight times during the day. So we were quite a bit less than that. We would move about every other day, depending on the terrain and the fence that we put up.
So obviously you found that it worked on your operation. You saw significant improvement even with the permanent fencing and then once you moved to the portable fencing. But again, like the neighbor across the road probably still was raising an eyebrow or two. And in your long experience, like what are some of the, let's say, the top three objections that often come up when we talk about these portable fencing systems and doing these high frequency movements of animals?
Well, the number one that we always get is how much grass do you actually graze? A lot of people think of we just graze everything and then move on. But when we were raising steers, we were after pounds of gain on the cattle, of course. So we were probably taking about 25% of the plant material. So we were after the really lush, high nutrient value grass on the leaves, and then we would move again. So for a lot of people, they look at that and it's like, oh, you're leaving way too much material behind. But in the end, we would come back in the wintertime and we had an opportunity to winter graze there a lot. And we would bring cattle, cows back from the neighbor, and we would was graze some of those plants again. So that was the first one. Second one is people really don't think that one wire electric fence works. And I can assure you it does. There's lots of times animals would go through an existing barbed wire fence, but they would never go over a one wire fence in the same paddock. So the animals get trained, but for the most part, you know, I was able to run a couple thousand steers by myself with some help from family. And my son at the time was working out, so he'd come home and help dad on the weekends. And that was enough to get by. So really efficient, right? Mm-hmm. One person running a couple thousand steers. But I couldn't have done that without some electric fence, some portable electric fence.
And what do you think would be number three of the objections?
Oh, it's just a traditional grazing mindset, I would suggest. People, you know, they like to leave the cattle in one spot. They like to go out and check with their horse. There's a, kind of that traditional mode that's out there. And it sometimes holds people back. There's lots of people, though, that use electric fence that still ride out every day to check cattle. You know, they're training horses, they're training cattle. That's all great. I used a side-by-side, actually, in a very traditional ranching operation. And yeah, there was cowboys looking across the fence, kind of wondering what's going on over there. But that's okay. I mean, we have a mix now. I think this next generation of ranchers, you'll see a mix where, yes, they might be training horses every day as they move cattle around, but they're using other equipment to help them manage at the same time. So it's pretty exciting. I've kind of got over the hump, I would suggest, and people starting to look, people are starting to manage. It's hard to say holistically, but they're certainly aware of the environment and the ability to graze in that environment. I mean, grazing, you can do almost everything. You could seed with it. You could harvest plant material. There's all kinds of things that cows can do if you have the opportunity to manage them. And management usually means some form of electric fence to help get that done.
Now, I think your second objection that people have with the electric fence and all that, I can see that being a common one, right? Like if somebody has never worked with electrical fence, it can be an intimidating beast. So mm-hmm. What are some of the beginning tricks and tips that you have in terms of making that transition as easeful as possible?
Yeah, and when I first started, I had a friend that was actually a Gallagher dealer, and I went over and visited him, and we started pretty small. I had a small Energizer, some high tensile wire, a used battery that he told me not to use, and we started there. So you can start pretty small. As you get going, there's a few tricks that you need to look at. One is Energizers. Keep in mind that Energizers all put out about 9 to 10,000 volts, but it's really the joules or the power behind that really matters. So when you buy an Energizer, make sure you buy an Energizer that's large enough for what you're doing. For instance, a 3-joule Energizer should probably be able to do about 10 miles of electric fence. That's a electric fence with insulators on it, sort of thing, a high tensile type fence. So that's one of the biggest things. The other one we get a lot of calls on is grounding. All Energizers need to be grounded. So the energy goes down the line through the animal, through their feet and back to the ground rod. So you can sort of think of the ground rod like a big antenna collecting electrons as in a simple form. And if the antenna is not big enough or the antenna is not in contact with the earth very well, then you'll have a grounding issue. And when we sell equipment to clients, we always show them how to look after their ground. You should be able to take, for instance, go down the fence line a couple hundred feet, ground out the wire with a piece of steel of some sort, ground the fence out. Make sure your fencer's off before you do that, though, because you'll have a little bit of a shock. So you ground out the fence, walk back, take your tester, and touch the ground rod. So you're measuring the amount of volts on the ground rod, and you'll have a little bit, perhaps 200 or 300 volts. But if you have 2,000 or 3,000 volts, for sure the ground rod's not working. And we'll see that quite often. People will maybe get a little cheap about their about fencing, so they might use, for instance, a sucker rod from the oil patch, and they'll pound that in 10 feet, and it's like, yeah, I've got a good ground rod. But that's probably one of the worst grounds. That sucker rod always has some corrosion around the outside of it and doesn't make very good contact. So a galvanized ground rod or a stainless steel ground rod is always better. And then, you know, you should have about 6 feet of ground rod for every 3 joules of fencer. So that's pretty important as well. And then we'll see problems in the winter times. You get lots of snow. It's hard for those animals to ground through their feet when they're standing on ice or snow. And so in those cases, sometimes we'll run a second wire, and we might run a hot wire with a ground wire, so a two-wire fence. And the wires are close together, or the electric rope is close together. So when the animal moves ahead, it usually ends up touching both wires at the same time, so they get grounded that way. Or you can run a bipolar energizer with two wires as well, and again, when the animals touch both wires, they get the big shock. So those are kind of the ones that everybody runs into. There's always little ones, and it's interesting, when our equipment goes out, my phone number is on a decal on the back, and I'll get calls. They're out there fencing, and it's like, hey, I don't think this is working, or help me with this. So there's lots of little things that people do. But I always tell everybody, by the end of the summer, you'll be able to teach. And that's usually the case. People pick up on the electric wire stuff really well. And by the end of the year, they'll be telling you about tricks and tips that they've done through the summer. So it's not too intimidating. What is intimidating, though, is you go into a fencing dealer and they might have 100 different products on the shelf, and it's hard to sort through that. And the trailers that we manufacture and sell, of course, come with everything they need in one package, and that helps quite a bit. But the old guys that have been doing electric fence for a long time, they get really good at picking products from one manufacturer and integrating those with another manufacturer. There's all kinds of great products out there that they can mix and match. And after you've been in fencing for a while, you get to know that. But for the first timer, it's good to kind of work through that, help them out a little bit, find those products that they can use. And it's not only the products, but of course we all want to fence in an inexpensive way as well. So there's ways to do that to help get everybody started, and then you can always add on later.
Now, you mentioned the winter conditions, and that was something I was going to mention in the piece. You know, that certainly could be a situation where people say, well, it gets awfully cold up here, so I don't think electric will work for me. Or we just had a rather dry summer in a lot of the areas. Same thing, right? People might say, oh, it's just not going to work for me. But similar principles would apply, mentioned.
Yeah, exactly. In winter, dry winter conditions, you may want to put another ground rod in, or maybe two more ground rods. And again, you may want to go back to a couple wires on the fence if you're in those areas where there's lots of heavy snow. And don't forget, cattle get trained. Like if they've experienced electric fence in the summertime when there is good grounding, it leaves a significant memory. Gallagher Vance calls it a big memory, a big shock for a big memory. And cattle do remember. And trained cattle, of course, are always easier in the wintertime, but they also get smart. The cattle get very smart. So they'll figure out some of the weak spots sometimes. And then have to fix those. Yeah.
There's always that one smart one, right? That leads everybody into trouble.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
Let's talk a bit more about the training portion. So you were running steers eventually. And so I imagine you would have had lots of new animals all the time and lots of need for training. So just walk us through a little bit what the best practices would be in that scenario.
Yeah, we used to buy a lot of cattle and they came from everywhere. You didn't know where they came from or what experience they did have. So right off the truck, we had a little bit of a training pen, and it had actually had about five wires on it. So alternating hot ground all the way down. And it just happened to be where we were calving before. So we just used the pen as a little bit of a training session. We turned the cattle in right off the truck that brought them, and they might be there for 4 or 5 hours. And somebody invariably would touch. Not everyone has to touch. Cattle will learn from one another. They'll watch somebody else touch. And sometimes there'll be some leaders within the group that will appear almost immediately, and they'll send someone else out to touch. That's what a leader will do, is send someone else out and then see what happens. And then we usually went to a field, and we'd start right off with a one-wire electric field later in the day. And invariably, there'd be two or three animals that might be out the next morning out of a group of 300 or 400. But that's okay. You put them back in. A lot of times they got shocked on the way out, and then they didn't want to go back in. So you had to provide an opportunity to let them back in. And usually within 3 or 4 days, everything was good. We could move ahead. I did have 5 dogs with me on my side by side. And of course that always helped a little bit. If they did get out, I could always put them back in. I mean, you give me some dogs and an electric fence and we could do anything.
You went from a scenario of having permanent fence and then to having more portable fence. Now there's also the fence line itself, right? That doesn't get any treatment when you have the permanent fence versus having the opportunity to fence along your similar ecosystems. Like, did you find that made a big difference there as well?
Yeah, when you moved when we were always trying to fence similar ecosystems. So in some places we actually took fence out, some old fence out. And of course, when the fence was first put in, it was put on legal boundaries. So these straight legal boundaries, quarter sections, often ended up where you might have a corner at the top of a hill, and that made an opportunity for the cattle to never want to go up there. So some of those fences had to come out. Back in 1998, I think it was, we had a huge fire that went through our place and a bunch of the neighbors. The fire burnt about 50,000 acres one afternoon in a big fire. We lost about half of our grass and about 30 miles of fence. And that actually gave us an opportunity to say, yep, we really didn't need the fence there anymore, the old fence. And then we started to put fences where we needed them. So if you look down on a map of the ranch, you'd see these fences going everywhere, anywhere, right? And that was okay. We were fencing ecosystems. I had an opportunity to talk to a group of people down in Ontario here a couple of years ago, and they had some fencing on 80 acres of flat land that was formerly a cornfield, actually. And they had a nice alley down the middle. They had fences that radiated out, and then they used some portable fence on top of that. And I can't remember. They probably had fence about every 300 feet that they could use. So it was, everything was uniform. The fence was there where they needed it. And it was very easy for those guys to move. And they actually were able to do a leader follower. So they actually sent some young cattle first, and they did got all the really nutritious plants. And then they were able to send their cow-calf pairs in afterwards probably 2 days afterwards or a day afterwards. But that's the only place I've actually seen that you could actually get away with a leader follower. For us, with different ecosystems, we might have a 100-acre field today, a 200-acre field tomorrow. We might have a north-facing slope that we want to apply a little bit more grazing pressure on versus a south-facing one that always got used. So it gave us the flexibility. So we had permanent fence mixed in with portable fence. And that gave us the ability to do that adaptive grazing, put more pressure on where we needed it. Sometimes we grazed at 100,000 pounds of animal per acre. Sometimes we maybe grazed at 20,000 pounds. So it became maybe a little harder to mentally keep track of that, but we were able to keep track in kind of a loose spreadsheet sort of thing. And we needed to be able to do that flexibility. I mean, that was another reason why we wanted to do some portable fence mixed in with the permanent. Really what we were doing was fencing into smaller and smaller increments of time. So it's the amount of time the animals were on. So that's another big paradigm shift for everyone when they start. It's not the number of animals that you have to worry about. It's the amount of time the animals are in each paddock. So again, when we ran steers, we moved fairly rapidly because we wanted that very high nutritious diet for the steers so we could get pounds of gain. And then when we did winter grazing with the neighbor's cows on those same acres, we could kind of slow down a little bit. We didn't have to worry about a regrowth because it was middle of the winter, so there was no regrowth to worry about. We still left a fair bit of thatch or cover on the ground, but we were able to do a little more grazing at that point. So really, every acre was summer grazed during an active growing season, and every acre was winter grazed during that dormant season. And we actually needed both to do the management that the grass actually required. So that's diversity of plants a little bit, but also diversity of the animals. So a grazing animal or a stalker in the summer, but back to a dry cow in the winter. So there was a little bit of diversity. Jim Garish has been out to our place, and Jim, of course, consults, and he looked at it last time he was out, and it's like, you really need some sheep. And Alan Nation that wrote The Grass Farmer, he was out at our place two times, actually. And as soon as he got out, it's like, Norman, you need some more animal diversity. You need some sheep. And I couldn't quite get that far, but we were able to do some of that with cows versus stalkers, or dry cows versus stalkers.
That's another paradigm shift, right? Like mm-hmm. Yeah. moving to multi-species. Now we're talking yet another paradigm shift. I'm curious on your rest periods in between. Like you mentioned, there's one grazing during the active growth period and then another one in the dormant season. But what have you found over time, like in terms of rest periods, what you could get away with and what was sort of the happy medium that your plants needed?
We were on our stalkers, we were probably approaching about 70 or 80 days of rest. So that meant that we usually only graze the paddock once. Sometimes we would be able to graze a paddock twice. If we're there early in the spring, fast growth in the spring, of course, what means fast moves, we might actually come back to that same paddock in September, October. That would be out of the ordinary, but sometimes we did. And really what we're doing is we're giving the grass a long time to recover. And it's really important to let that grass have the opportunity to not only regrow the canopy, but to regrow the roots. So when a plant is grazed, the plant will take some of its energy again from the roots and sacrifice some roots and use that to regrow the canopy. And then once the canopy is up, he uses the new energy from the canopy to regrow the roots. So we see a lot of time people will see the canopy regrow, and it's like, yeah, we're going to go back in there. And usually what happens is the roots get shallower and shallower and shallower as the animals come back too soon. Sort of closer to the continuously grazed scenario where the animal might come back in 4 or 5 days to regraze. This time the animal might come back in 35 or 40 days, yet the root hasn't hasn't recovered. So in our new situation where my son ranches in Fort St. John area, that was a paradigm shift for us, because summer, of course, June 21st, there's lots of sunlight. There's lots of moisture usually. So yeah, maybe in that instance, we could get away with 40 days or 45 days versus the 80. I mean, obviously the grass blind had regrown, and it was at a point where the roots have actually regrown as well. Don Campbell over at Meadow Lakes, Saskatchewan, taught a lot of holistic management courses. Don's in an area that with a little more summer moisture, a little more summer daylight. And they thought that they needed about 45, 50 days. And the longer that Don used adaptive grazing, the longer the grazing, the rest period became. So in the end, Don had probably added on 10 or 15 more days at least. So he was happy to regraze plants that have actually gone into seed again, that much rest period in between, that allowed the plant to regrow and actually set seed. He was suggesting that the benefits for the plant and the ecosystem was much greater than the benefits he may have got from the extra pounds of animal per acre. So a full flexibility. And, you know, I tell people really that watch the plants, right? The plants will tell you when you're going to be able to come back again. Don't get hung up on some chart that you may put together and it's like, yep, I have to move every other day, or I had an opportunity to be in Costa Rica here a couple years ago and a lot of electric fence there, but you could tell that they were moving maybe once a week, like every Friday morning or every Saturday morning or whatever. And even though they had the electric fence and they were moving cattle, they had missed a significant opportunity to manage some of the roots or the regrowth on the plants. And you could see it, you know, once you get out into it, it was pretty evident what they were doing. They were moving to a chart rather than moving to the plants. So,
on your operation and as you went through your career, you say like the plants are a good indicator, but you went further after that, right? And now a lot of people are interested in soil health and understanding like what is actually going on underneath. And there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. So you got a bit more into that as well. And maybe you can share a bit of the observations and measurements that you take for underground.
Yeah, exactly. It's been at least 10 years now. PFRA came and wanted to do a water study, a soil water study. So the study consisted of digging down about 4 feet. You put a water sensor in and some wires to the top of the ground so you can plug your computer in and actually see what happened on a rainfall event, for instance. So we did my side of the fence versus the neighbors. The neighbors wasn't exactly continuous grazing, but they would come in August and leave in October probably. So really good grass managers, but still a semi-continuous graze system. Larger rough fescue plants, older rough fescue plants. And if you pulled the material on top of the ground away, more actual bare ground between the plants versus the other side of the fence where we were probably doing 80 to 100,000 pounds of animal per acre per day. So the plant community quite tighter, but the same plants on both sides, same actual plant community on both sides. So the first year we did the study, it's like, you know, we had quite a bit more water holding capacity in the soil. The second year was more, and the PFRA soils person that was doing the experiment was a little unsure about what was going on. I mean, he kept listening to me spout off about some of this stuff, but this, he wasn't quite convinced perhaps. But by year three, it's like, it was pretty evident that we had about twice as much soil water as the neighbor across the fence did. And at that point, 10 years ago, we didn't really have an understanding of what was going on. And of course, now we know it's that microbial community that's really starting to hold some of the moisture in the soil. So as you do the adaptive grazing, really what was going on is we were changing the microbial community in the soil. And that's where we were getting all of our benefits. So yeah, some of it was animal density. Some of it was the microbiome of the animal saliva, the microbiome of the hair that touches the grass plants, the microbiome that came from the rumen that ended up through the manure on the plants, all of that started to come together and a pretty dynamic system that's going on in the soil. We see partially what's going on top. You get a more complex ecosystem on top. But I would suggest the ecosystem in the soil is way, way more than what you see on top, perhaps 100 times more diversity and microbial community in the soil than what you see on the top. So pretty interesting. And I think that's really what's driving this. We talk a lot about regenerative agriculture. We talk about adapting farmland to a more regenerative process. And we're talking about managing more cover crops. And we're talking about integrating livestock into those scenarios. But in the end, it's really about feeding the microbes in the soil. And the microbes, of course, like, for instance, fungi, being able to feed the plant as well, some of those nutrients that the plant can't pick up, fungi can pick up, and they do a little horse trade between the two of them. One gets sugar and the other one gets nutrients in the soil from the soil. So it's really those dynamics underneath that are really starting to drive the regenerative agriculture management.
Now you touched on something that seems to be a bit of the next frontier, which is the livestock integration in what may traditionally only have been annual cropping. Mm-hmm. So I believe you had some experience with that as well in terms of providing some electrical fencing for scenarios like that.
Yeah, we do. And this year has been really hard for the ag community. It's been very dry for most of Western Canada. You know, they had a really poor crop, and then it did start to rain a little bit in the fall. They had a flush of plants that came back. And of course, the neighbor who had the cattle across the fence would sure like to graze that. So we had a lot of portable electric fence that went out to help in those situations. But it also started to give kind of a paradigm shift for the farmers that, yes, I could have animals back on. Yes, we could have some portable electric fence and the fence is all gone. So I don't have to worry about my 100-foot sprayer hitting a fence post later on next summer. So we could see some integration again. I've seen one scenario, an organic farmer that actually required some animals to come over and help them. The animals were there for essentially weed control, but then they saw after a while all the nutrient benefits that came with the animals when they started to do that. And in this scenario, the organic crop scenario, they had a full integration of livestock into that cropping scenario where they couldn't use fertilizer or spray, and that they could see the benefit right off the bat. And we're starting to see, there's a group of young farmers in southern Alberta that still had access to cattle, but they were really dedicated to farming, and they could see the benefits. I know the fellow sent me back a picture of a plant root that had grown down about 2 inches and then went straight sideways, like some really hard packed soil that was the result of probably 100 years of farming. And they started to go back to cover crops in between, maybe a cover crop 1 year, and then maybe they'll cereal farm for 2-3 years and then back to cover crop with the integration of livestock. So we're starting to see that again. For next year, I think the federal government will probably see a federal program that would be aimed at reducing nitrogen fertilizer, but also increasing cover crop and increasing some form of rotational grazing, which is really the reintroduction of livestock into those cropping scenarios. So it's starting to change. We're starting to see it all over. Wrangler Jeans, the guy that makes your pants, Wranglers, has a program called Wrangler Roots. And Wrangler Roots is all about cover crop mixed into their cotton production that produces the jeans. So if you've ever been around a cotton farm later on down in Texas, it kind of looks like a moonscape after they take the cotton off. So they've gone down. Wrangler recognizes that they need to be sustainable. So they're starting to promote cover crop within those type of cotton production systems. So it's starting to reappear everywhere. right? And it's really exciting to have this regenerative agriculture scenario come in and spread across North America.
Now, if somebody is mildly intrigued or interested, or maybe has tinkered with electrical fence, but just, you know, never quite gotten there, what can you tell them about the products that you have available that might make it just a little bit easier for them?
Yeah, well, we started off, I think it's been about 14 years since we built our first trailer, and the first one I had to wind up by hand. But, you know, gradually we got to a point where we have our larger model. It's about 1,000 pounds, so you can still pull it around with a quad. It has a couple miles of wire on an electric reel. That trailer, big enough solar panel, like a 6 joule solar, 6 joule energizer with a larger solar panel. We could power as much as 20 miles, but we use it for portable electric fence for the most part. So that's a bigger model that we have. We brought in a smaller model later on. This has been out about, we're on our fifth year perhaps, a little bit smaller, a 3 joule energizer. And that particular trailer uses half mile reels that you can interchange on the trailer. So you might put out half a mile, you might put another half a mile out and just tie the rope together. You might put out three miles that way. So it gives you the flexibility to do small and large. The large trailer can fence a quarter section, which was really what we were after. And we see people that, you know, they might be able to graze some stubble, or maybe the neighbor puts a quarter section of corn in for them, or maybe they swath graze or bale graze the neighbor's place. So that the larger trailer gives you the opportunity to fence a quarter off, and then you could fence back and forth within that. The smaller trailer, you could still do that, but it's good for smaller applications. It was really designed for high intensity grazing, where you have a back fence and a forward fence, which gives you a paddock. And the third fence would be for the paddock you're going to move into. So it's really designed for 3 half-mile reels to go out to make 3 separate fences. So you're actually able to back fence and forward fence as you continue on. That was for the more professional grazers out there. We sell a lot of that trailer, and a lot of it is used for convenience. They might make an alley back to a water trough. They might make a temporary corral one day. They might put up a fence that allows them to move their cattle past the neighbor's canola field just to make it easier. There's all kinds of ways that they could use it. Sometimes they'll use the fence around a riparian area, or they might have to put some cattle, but they want to keep the riparian area with no grazing. And then they might actually go back late in the fall and pick up the riparian area again with a portable fence and put the cattle in the area. So they're starting to be able to manage the riparian areas with a different grazing regime. But before, they couldn't do that. Permanent fence always made trailing next to a riparian area. So now they're able to manage that and treat those areas with different management at different times of the year. So that opened up a whole different type of management. Our systems are designed so you can fence at about 1 mile per hour by yourself. That's either putting the fence up or taking it down. So when you're able to do that, it opens up a whole different management style that you can do. It's like, you know, I really don't want to have the fence there, or I really didn't want to have a permanent fence there. But now with portable, it's like, yeah, for an hour's worth of labor, I can put something up and then take it back down, and we'll move the fence somewhere else. So it just opens up a whole different scenarios that you're able to do.
So obviously it's a bit of an investment, right, as mm-hmm. anything on your operation. But maybe if we're thinking about if you would have to put up a permanent fence in this place, or the labor saving component, like have you done any sort of economical numbers around that mm-hmm. to help people wrap their head around what the investment equates to?
Yeah, we're getting close to about the same price on a per mile basis. So say we put up 2 miles of fence. A permanent fence with the high cost of posts and the wire, the barbed wire that goes on, we're about the same price on a 2 mile stretch. But you can take our machine, of course, and use it over and over and over on some other place. So we're starting to see that trade off. It's like, do I put that? I hate to say expensive, because there's lots of applications where permanent barbed wire probably the number one thing that you would go to. But we're seeing scenarios now where do I really need to do that? Do I really need to spend, you know, $8,000 or $10,000 for a mile of that, and then I'm stuck with it? So can you fence off common ecosystems with that? Well, then it gets really expensive if you're going to do that. So you have lots of fence up, and you just don't want a lot of permanent fence. There's lots of areas where we were in Granham. Of course, we attracted a lot of wildlife. So we talk about diversity of grazing and diversity of animals. I didn't always provide that diversity. We had a lot of deer and elk that came. So as the ecosystem became more diverse and complex and functioning again, we also attracted other wildlife. And 400 head of elk going through high tensile wire was not a good scenario. So again, that's where we started to use more portable electric fence for that.
Now, if folks are interested, how are they best getting a hold of you or finding out more about your products?
Yeah, we've got an excellent website that has a lot of training, a lot of pictures. You can reach that website at www.rangeward.ca. That's usually the best, and people can browse through the website. There's videos on there. The website is really training and provides the opportunity to see our electric fence working. And then, of course, within the website there, we have two or three places where you can contact either myself or our general sales manager as well.
Now, I know we could have still talked for probably another hour about all the different projects that you were involved in, or even future projects. What are sort of your parting thoughts that you would like to leave the audience with?
Well, I think don't be afraid to start with some electric fence. Start small, start as inexpensive as you can get, and start from there. It's always easy to add on and get bigger. We were basically designed for fencing for larger landscapes, but there's lots of product out there from New Zealand, Gallagher SpeedRite product that's designed for smaller applications. It doesn't matter the size, doesn't matter how big you want to get or how intense you want to get. When I talked about that leader follower grazing scenario in Ontario, well, that's like going from peewee hockey to NHL management style, right? And you don't have to do that. I talked about Ryan Boyd doing 1.2 million pounds of animal per acre per day. That's like the elite. Just fencing off a field in half provides you a significant change and improvement in management. And that might be just a half a mile that you have to put up. Could be portable, could be permanent. Either one, it really doesn't matter. And you can start to see some of those benefits. And we have many people that start that way. And we sell to a full range of people that are starting out right from nothing. But we see a lot of high-intensity guys come back to us. They maybe have a lot of paddocks or permanent paddocks, and they're finding they still need to integrate some portable fence into those areas as well. So a full range. Don't be afraid to start a little bit. Don't be afraid to call us. I mean, we help and consult with a lot of grazing operations throughout North America, and we are here to help. And a lot of times 15 minutes talk on the phone will help people get started, and then they'll be back later on at some point to integrate and do some larger products. But that would be the biggest one. Just get started.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Nadia. And there's a lot of resource out there besides, of course, Range Ward, but yeah. The forage associations across Western Canada are key. See if you can join one of those, take some field days in. There's lots of experience there that you can tap into. The information is enormous there. I follow a lot of people on YouTube. You can talk, or you can see Alan Williams or Christine Jones or Nicole Masters or Gabe Brown or, you know, Jim Garish. They're all there. And 20 minutes on YouTube will just about get you everything you need as well. So take the information, play with your computer this winter. Gather some information, take on some of these forage field day events that are available through the summer.
Thanks again, Norm.
Thanks, Nadia. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
If you enjoyed this chat, check out the other episodes in this brief 5-part grazing series. Also visit bcforagecouncil.ca and peaceforage.bc.ca for more great information on regionally relevant forage and pasture management tips. Funding for this project has in part been provided by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada through the Agriculture Climate Solutions Living Labs program.